When the first pioneers reached this region, they described the prairie as a vast sea of grass. You see, the prairie cordgrass and the tall blue stem, they would grow as tall as 10 feet. And when the wind blew, and it always blows, the wind would cause waves across this beautiful, shimmering plain. It was said that even on horseback, it was easy to get lost on this smooth land with endless horizon and limitless possibility. When I first returned to the prairie in 2006, I'd often remark that this place is so big that it can be humbling. It can make you feel extraordinarily small. But it's also so vast and open that it leaves room for the powerful questions, for the most beautiful creations, and for the biggest dreams and visions. And that's where we start today, with Space to Dream. Hi, I'm Hugh Weber. Welcome to the Potluck Society. If we're going to take the time to do an entire episode about space, it means that we need to talk to Stephen Shaparo of Visionarian Studios. They describe themselves as a trusted steward of story in space. Stephen's a storyteller, so I'm going to let him get started.
Hi, my name is Stephen. I'm a storyteller and strategist. I help vision addicts find the space between vision and fulfillment.
Okay, friend, you're going to need to tell us what that means.
I think what that describes is sort of a product of where I am in my own journey, where I have, in a sense, come to realize, you know, I had a friend, a really good friend. In fact, he's also works with us at Visionarian Studios. We were talking, you know, really deep conversations about our own journeys. And he asked me, what is it that you desire to help people with? And the three things that have really stuck in my mind about what I hope to be able to help people with is to help them discover their identity, to help them to discover community, and to help them to find people, either one, that can help them along in their own journeys, or two, people that they themselves can act as a mentor in. And then he asked me a really pointed question. He says, have you found those for yourself? And, you know, it was a really disarming question because it was really uncomfortable because on one hand, I think that I have found those things in my life. But then I realized that question really forced me to realize that those are some of the things that I crave as an individual. And so he said this one thing that summed it up. He says, the thing that you desire the most for others is the thing that you desire most for yourself. For me, it was boom. You know, it really hit me, you know, sort of in the heart, that made me realize that that's what I seek for in myself and frankly for others. And so when that description says a vision addict, it describes me as a person who is very passionate about thinking about the future, the things that could be, the things that should be, living in the future and having a very hard time of living in the present. And so my own journey of realizing that there are decisions that I've made in my own life of, in a sense, either one, having a door closed behind me, or two, me closing the door behind me and looking towards that next chapter, next thing that I want to do, or I believe that is waiting for me in my own life, and realizing that the time between, in a sense, the space between the closing of one door and the opening of the second door, many times takes a lot longer if I'm patient, if I'm wise, and if I know that I can't force things to happen. That space between those two doors can sometimes be hell in the hallway. There's a lot to learn from that. And so my own journey of kind of just navigating that space between vision and fulfillment is one that I've navigated for the last, say, 20 years. And so I want to be able to be a resource to people that are in that same space, in that hell in the hallway, so to speak. And I think that space between, just, it can manifest itself in many different ways. So at Visionary Studios, you know, our mission is to launch inspired vision into reality. So people that have a vision for either a culture within their organization, they have a paradigm shift that they want to undergo, and they see the value of their physical environment as a tool for, in a sense, housing, if not catalyzing that shift in the organization. That's really a lot of my view, is that the built environment is a form of cultural architecture.
So we're already moving quickly from basic introductions into Stephen's personal journey to Visionarian's focus and approach to this idea of the built environment as a tool for cultural change. Now we're going to turn to Winston Churchill.
He had a way with words that have just really resonated with me. And one of the quotes that I subscribe to is where he says, "We shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us." And has been a quote that has really impacted me when I think of this idea of cultural architecture, the crafting of culture. I truly believe that we as a people, whatever culture we subscribe to, especially if I think of an organization that has a culture about it, a DNA, a story about it, in terms of their mission, vision, values, I think that one of the ways that they express that is through the physical environment that they work in, that they live in. And I think their culture can absolutely shape their environment, meaning that, say, if this is an organization or a corporation, that their values of collaboration, their values of charity, their values of innovation can absolutely manifest themselves in their workplace. But I think the converse is true as well. I think that the environment in which they work can absolutely help to steer and, in a sense, create the culture that they are aspiring to. Many times when we work with organizations, we have found that it's one or the other. Either one, the story of their organization, their mission is very clear, and they just have realized that their physical environment, their workplace, does not align with their culture. And so, they have cubicles, but they have a value of innovation or collaboration. They have this very hierarchical set of spaces that does not exhibit a flat organization. And so they realize that there's a misalignment. The other way of looking at it is that many times their spaces do, in a sense, exhibit sort of a specific value, but the organization itself is still aspiring to those values. So in a sense, a leader may come in and say, we're here to ignite change. We're here to ignite a movement within an organization. We are moving in a certain direction. It's going to require a paradigm shift. So in a sense, their space, the change of their space, is sort of the incarnation of what they want their organization to be. So they use the space to help exhibit the values, to embody the values that they aspire to. And it gives the organization, the members of the organization, the employees, the leaders, sort of this idea of what type of behaviors and mindsets that they could have by merely just being in these spaces.
This makes complete sense to me, but I still can't decide if organizations or individuals actually would know if their space was resonant or dissonant with their culture. Stephen talks about this a little bit.
Why is it that there are some spaces, not so much just a workplace, but also it may be retail, it may be a coffee shop, it may be just an open common area. Why is it that I like these spaces? What is it that draws me to it? I think there's an element of psychology, there's an element of sociology in it. There's almost a cultural anthropology about it that that brings people together. I think when you have this intersection, I would say almost this overlap between story, meaning, culture, so that story overlapping with space, and that these two things are aligned within each other. In ecology, there's this concept of ecotone, and it is where two separate ecosystems overlap, and that there are species, there are biological species that can only exist in that overlap, that they would not exist if they were just in one ecosystem or the other. So this overlap is where that magic happens. And I think that many times people may not innately know why or why not something works. It's something that they feel innately. And I think it comes, it requires that there are people that can come alongside and maybe express some of these ideas about how important the physical environment does in fact affect culture. And I think for most people, if they got it right, they know it. If they don't have it right, they know it. They may not know why or why not, but they know it. They know when they feel like the physical environment actually helps to perpetuate either a psychology or even a culture that they love. And so it's, I don't think everybody has the language. I think that's what I'm referring to, is they may know it innately. They just don't know how, they don't have a language for it. And there are people out there, that really are in a sense providing language, for people to understand the value of the physical environment to help, craft a desired culture.
But does this idea of space impacting culture and practice have impacts beyond physical buildings to our communities, to our regions?
The design that we do at Visionary Studios, we look at space in sort of three realms. We think of it as in one aspect, it's the space inside. And that's where we talk about the space inside buildings, that architecture is really about giving form and function to space. And so we call that positive space in terms of what happens inside of a building. So that can be architecture and interior design. But we also talk on the second level about the space between. And that is in architectural terms, we call that the negative space. It's the space between buildings. And that becomes a really important aspect of the lifeblood of a place, is not just about inside space, but it's about the space in between forms. And then the third level is we talk about the space beyond. And that is, in a sense, the space beyond the property lines. And so that becomes more of an urban design question as opposed to architecture and landscape architecture. So when we talk about the space beyond, it is really about how does a place affect the greater community. And in effect, it means this greater effect has, in a sense, nothing to do with us, but has everything to do with how we impact the greater community. And so absolutely that can pertain to a neighborhood, it can pertain to a city, it can pertain to a region or a state, if not a country, but it can absolutely happen within the community. That if a space is made, I had the wonderful opportunity to go to London, my wife and I, for our anniversary, and there was the new museum was reopened, and they had an exhibit. And one of the things that they showed was in this Indian ghetto, the community decided to have carved out from within the ghetto amongst all these tents. They had this this sort of exhibit slash museum, a pop-up museum that basically showed the art of some of the residents. And the catalyzation that pop-up museum produced within the community to bring pride, to exhibit, the skills and talents of their people and what it did to make a difference in that community. And that's just one very minor example of what a physical space can do to help catalyze change in culture.
But both Stephen and Visioneering recognize that there's something else at play here, and that's story, shared stories, communal and cultural stories. Stephen shares an anecdote about how he views this design of stories and its critical role.
The Woman in Gold is about this Austrian lady who had emigrated to America after fleeing from Austria during the Nazi occupation. She was forced to flee, and in fleeing, she had to leave behind her two parents to really take advantage of an open window of time for her to flee. And just before she left, she sat down with her parents weeping because she knew that this was going to be the last time she would see her parents. And they saw that she was visibly shaken and torn by the decision. But there was one thing that her father said. You know, they said that she needed to go, that America would be her future, that her America would be her new home. And then literally in the movie, the father switches from speaking German to speaking English. And he says, "And from now on, we will speak in the language of your future." And it was just a powerful statement for me to realize that even just the change in language. And even in the movie, she later on in her elderly years, she refused to speak in Austrian. She only spoke in English because that was her future and her present. To speak Austrian for her was to go back in time and to, in a sense, go back to an old paradigm.
This vignette from a film shared by Stephen made me unexpectedly emotional. I think this is where so many of our small towns are, somehow stuck between the stories of their past and the stories of their future. And so I asked Stephen what advice he had for these small towns as they build their shared future and change their shared language. He had another anecdote.
I'm not sure why this is coming to mind, but I remember listening to a TED Talk, and I forget her name now, but she is a singer and banjo picker, and she studied. She's, a white lady from America who had a passion for the Chinese culture. She traveled to China and learned the Mandarin language and began to incorporate Mandarin songs into her music. And I was listening to her talk, and if not an interview, and she was asked, how do you come up with these songs? How do you create music? And there was one thing that she said: in order to create the new, I listen to the old. And so what she was saying is she would listen to old speeches. She would listen to old music. She would read old literature. And she would, in a sense, try to find inspiration by connecting, in a sense, old ideas to each other. And by connecting old ideas to each other, she was inspired to create new ideas. And so I don't think it's about forsaking, in a sense, our history. I actually think that the future will be inspired by the past. It can't come in the same form of old ideas. It has to be about connecting old ideas so that they can, in a sense, if you connect an old idea one with old idea two, then you will arrive at a new idea number three. So I think that there's this openness. It's about creating space to say, what is it about us? And talking about the things that make up the history of our communities and say, what is it about us that will inspire something new? I remember talking with a community that was very hesitant to think about creating something new because they said, these buildings were nailed together by my grandfather. These buildings were the product of sacrifice, hard work, and they took risks. They sacrificed a lot of money and time, and we don't want to dishonor them. And then I came back with a question, and I said, well, what would personify your grandfather? Your grandfather was a pioneer. Your grandfather was one who actually took risks, traveled across the country, if not emigrated from another country, took risks to bring his family to this part of the country, to actually work hard and to spend his money to buy the tools, to buy the materials, to craft this building, a center of the community. They were a pioneer. What greater honor could you give your grandfather but by being a pioneer yourself and to take the risk to do something that was just as risk-taking as your grandfather's. And so when they saw it in that light, they realized that they could literally embody sort of the legacy of their grandparents by taking risks and moving forward to do something that they had never done before, because that's what their grandparents had done.
Throughout this conversation, I was beginning to get the impression that maybe the physical build was less important to Stephen than the cultural outcomes, than the evolution of human beings, than the growth of richer, more beautiful lives.
Yeah, I think for me, the design of physical environments is not the end. It's just a means. It's just a means to cultural transformation. And if you can create spaces that, in fact, create environments for people to actually see change in their own lives, because that's at the very core of who I am. I want to be part of work that actually is able to bring change to people, because if it's just for the sake of great design and it doesn't transform people, then there's really no soul to it. I think great design changes people, regardless of what the design is. It changes people. It changes culture. It creates culture. It makes our lives better.
If improving people's lives is your goal, Stephen, I can assure you've done it, both with myself and so many others. I want to make one note about this interview, and I hope it doesn't make Stephen self-conscious, but you can hear throughout the interview that he's a little bit out of breath. Stephen was actually in recovery for the kidney donation that he had made to his father, having given completely from his own body to someone else to make their lives a little better. This space we occupy in South Dakota, I really believe, is one of those intersections, one of those places of ecotone where East meets West, where prairie meets frontier, where so many things are coming into collision and connections are being formed and reformed. I believe this is the kind of place that can reinvent itself, that can reemerge, that can develop a new narrative, that can be maybe a birthplace of a new conversation of what it is to live in small towns, what it is to tell stories of rural and remote, what it is to overcome the elements and build things and cultures that transform. Thank you for joining us this week, Stephen, and for all of you for sharing the journey with us. We're building something extraordinary. In the spirit of combining two old things into something new, this week I'm going to put the workload on your shoulders. Our action antidote for the week is to find two old things, combine them, and make something new. Now, this may be introducing two old friends that have never had the opportunity to meet. It may be adding two ingredients to a dish that you wouldn't otherwise combine, or it may be sitting down with a pad of paper and a pencil and drawing out our shared future together. That's it. You did it. Thanks this week to our friends at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Their support matters more to this program, to this podcast, to the potluck, than anyone else. Their willingness to share it through their website, through their airwaves, means that we get to share these stories around the world. Thanks this week to Carl Koiser for his help on the audio, and to the fellows over at Pony Creek Studios for continuing to provide our theme music. A final word of thanks this week to listener John. John has been offering up incredibly detailed and sincere and vulnerable feedback to all of our episodes, and each bit of wisdom that he shares with me makes this program and the stories we get to share richer. It has been a joy seeing you here at the Potluck Society. I do hope we'll see you soon. And as always, don't forget to bring an idea to pass.